Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
They say choose your friends wisely. How's that working for the Tories? Welcome to Political Fix, your essential insider guide to Westminster, from the Financial Times, with me, Lucy Fisher. Coming up, who's an extremist in the UK? The government devises a new definition, just as a Tory party donor is accused of racism and calling for an MP to be shot. With me here in the FT studio to discuss some of these issues are Political Fix regulars Stephen Bush. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Lucy.
And Robert Shrimsley.
Hi, Lucy.
Hi, Robert. And also joining the show today is Hannah White, director of the Institute for Government Think Tank. Hi, Hannah.
Hello.
So, Hannah, we're going to talk to you shortly about why prime ministers fail to implement their agendas and how reforms to the centre of government could help. But I wanted to kick off with something else, which is extremism. The government's come up this week with a new definition of what counts as extremism and how it will identify groups it considers too extreme to fund or engage with. Communities Secretary Michael Gove had this to say to the BBC.
I think it's important when government seeks to work to counter hatred, when we're working on the ground in communities with grassroots organisations, that we're able to choose our friends wisely. And in so doing, we want to avoid some of the errors of the past where government money and sponsorship has gone towards individuals and organisations that have been extremist.
So, Robert, before we get into what the definition is, who it might net, let's just step back. Why is the government saying that it needs to redefine what extremism is?
Well, I mean, it's a good question. Officially, it's partly to do with the gap between the hate speech laws that exist currently and the current prescriptions on extreme organisations. But I think it's been a long standing bugbear of Michael Gove's. It's something that he has wanted to do for a long time. He has pushed the government in this direction on its strategy towards extremists. Obviously, some of the things the Conservative Party has been doing since the Hamas attack and the bombing of Gaza have pushed this agenda forward, and we saw Rishi Sunak talking about it a couple of weeks ago. I think it's a combination of all these things wrapped up together. They think the climate is there, they think there is an issue, and some of them have been pushing on it for a very long time.
And Stephen, just take us through what this definition encapsulates and how Michael Gove has rolled it out this week.
Its definition of extremism is people who support ideologies based on violence that seek to negate fundamental rights and the operation of the United Kingdom as a liberal democracy. So some of those bits are already the bits which are controversial within the Conservative Party and outside of it. But then the extra bit is anyone who creates a atmosphere which is conducive to people doing the first two things. I would say the bits which are politically difficult even within the Conservative Party is, one, you could argue that innately liberal democracy is unfortunately conducive to people who wanted to destroy liberal democracies, right? That's why they are more vulnerable than other forms of government. And then the second is that quite a lot of culture war debates, both sides of them would argue that the other side seeks to negate fundamental rights of others, right? So, you know, for example, if you are pro-reproductive rights and reproductive freedom, you think that your opponents are seeking to reduce the fundamental rights of women if you're opposing abortion. And if you are anti-abortion, you think that your opponents are negating the fundamental rights of the unborn, right? So there's already an argument that this definition is too expansive, but the essential policy problem it's seeking to solve is that in the past, most violent terror attacks were directed, i.e. by an autonomous terror cell or by someone, you know, planning something somewhere. And now they are increasingly what the security service call inspired, i.e. someone watches a bunch of videos by extreme right terror group or by an Islamist terror preacher, and they go, oh, I know what I'm going to do is I'm going to, you know, get in a car, drive into someone, plan a nail bomb. And so the idea is that you broaden the definition of extremism to make it easier to catch in your net people who are inspiring rather than directly.
But I think it goes broader. I think it goes broader than the issue of terrorism as we normally think of it. It goes to the question of cultures of intimidation, which people have felt at different levels of government and public life. And it's about saying to government bodies, people like this are not the people you should be taking advice from.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I think it goes beyond the conventional form of terror. Some of these organizations, they're not people to be trusted on preserving the values that we like. And I mean, in the Commons, he then went on to name under privilege five organizations, three of them involved with British Muslims and two of them from the far right. The far right, I have to say, I don't think either of them were ever likely to be called in to advise on government strategy. But it's around that territory too.
Yeah, but Rob, I think you make an interesting point that it's quite limited in what it does. Yes, if you're named under this definition, and part of it is about naming and shaming, then the central government is blocked from engaging with you or, you know, mm-hmm. channeling taxpayer funding to you. But at least to begin with, it won't bind councils or arm's length bodies, the CPS, police forces, universities, others. So in some ways, I'm not surprised that Labour have come out and said almost counterintuitively, perhaps, it doesn't go far enough.
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised by the relatively limited nature of it, but I think it reflects what Stephen was alluding to about the backlash that's come from people within the Conservative Party who worry about how this might be used when they're out of office, which they recognise could be not that long away. I saw quite a significant figure on the Conservative right, Robert Colville, who runs the Centre for Policy Studies, was attacking a new document by Hope Not Hate, which he said, when you went through it, it was full of pictures of members of the Conservative Party, like Suella Braverman and the New Conservatives, and also Nigel Farage. And so you can just see how this kind of policy thinking could be turned back on them very, very quickly if they're not careful. And I think that's partly why it's a bit more muted than some of the fanfare might have suggested.
Hannah?
And the question for me is what the political gain is here, because there's a ability to sort of look like you're being tough with these groups, and there's a response to some of the debates which we've been having lately. But I'm not clear, given how little time there is now before the next election, what difference it's actually going to make. But I don't know what your view is on that.
Obviously, yeah, the thing which is a bit weird about all of the fanfare is that there already exists a mechanism to prescribe
exactly.
organisations, and simply naming some more but not prescribing them is pretty weak source. The thing that, you know, I certainly bore on a lot about is in both 2010 and in 1997, the governments of John Major and Gordon Brown were doing these kind of like death or glory runs of things that they desperately wanted to get done before they got turfed out. And in some ways, really, this is basically the closest equivalent to Harriet Harman doing the Equality Act, John Major trying to put rocket boosters under the peace process.
Theresa May doing net zero.
Theresa May, yeah.
I think one should, although we're always drawn to this is wedge politics, this is electoral thinking. And you do sometimes have to allow for the fact that they just believe this.
Mm.
They actually believe in this.
But is there electoral mileage in this, Robert? As Stephen says, this is a kind of a pet issue of Michael Gove's. He's long sort of advocated for the drain the swamp policy towards, you know, Muslim groups with Islamist leanings. But as we approach the end of this week, as Stephen pointed out, he's ended up upsetting the Tory right, who think it could restrict freedom of speech, freedom of worship with regards to abortion rights, assisted dying, opposition to trans rights. He's also annoyed the centrists in his party, who are concerned that this could net mainstream Muslim groups and therefore unfairly demonise people.
I mean, I don't think there's a lot of electoral mileage, not least because the issues that are primarily concerning the country are not this one. They're the NHS, they're the cost of living, and then that comes immigration, which you could say maybe this touches on for some people, but not really. But I do think that if you are looking for any electoral gain, it is just conceivable that it pulls back people from the conservative fringe who might have gone to reform. But no, I mean, I think if they're hoping for an electoral bounce off this, they're going to be disappointed.
Well, let's move on to the row engulfing Frank Hester, the healthcare technology entrepreneur who's the Tories' biggest ever donor after he gave a whopping £10 million to the party last year. And it should be added, a personal donation to Rishi Sunak, or donation in kind, I should say, in the form of a £15,000 odd helicopter ride. The Guardian revealed on Monday that he'd previously said that looking at Diane Abbott made you just want to hate all black women and that she should be shot. He accepts that he made rude remarks about Abbott. He insists they had nothing to do with the colour of her skin or her gender. Stephen, huge problem for the Tories, this, isn't it? How do you assess how they've handled this, and Sunak in particular?
They've handled it badly. I mean, you know, like,
understatement of the episode.
It's a good example of how they had very few political options, right? Obviously, those remarks, as reported, are open and shut racist, right? It's literally like the dictionary definition of, you know, you can't say that like an individual person makes you hate all people who share their race and gender characteristics. And then if you turn around and say it had nothing to do with her race and gender, it raises questions like, do you understand English or speech or concepts? But obviously, the Conservative Party doesn't have £10 million spare down the back of a sofa. They actually can't give the money back, right? So if you are Rishi Sunak, very obviously what you needed to do is say right away, of course this statement, as reported, is racist. And then actually you should just front up the fact that you can't return the £10 million because you've spent some of it and you don't have £10 million just lying around somewhere. I mean, technically he does, but probably not in a liquid state, and he can give the Conservative Party. Instead of doing this sort of slightly ridiculous theatre of first saying it was wrong, but, you know, not being able to articulate why, sending out ministers to also do this. So I think Mel Stride was the one who had the unfortunate, like, oh, you know, these comments weren't about gender or race. And it's like, well, for a party which likes to go on about how other people don't know what a woman is, apparently they don't know what a woman or being black refers to. And then, of course, at about 4 o'clock, Kemi Badenoch said what obviously Rishi should have said. And then he took another couple of hours to get to that position. And I think the thing that has spooked a lot of Conservative MPs is, unlike the Lee Anderson row, when Lee Anderson said that Sadiq Khan had given London over to his mates and that Islamists had taken control of the London mayor, yeah, there is a constituency for that kind of remark within the Conservative Party. Whereas there is not a single Conservative MP who thinks that those remarks, as reported, are defensible, right? There are some Conservative MPs who might go, well, I wouldn't trust anything that's in The Guardian. But it raises the question for lots of MPs of, well, if you can't deal with this fairly open and shut case when there's nothing politically difficult to manage yourself around, in which you have very limited options because you can't give the money back and you can't defend it, how is this guy and how is his operation going to hold up during an election campaign? I think it's why, you know, we are going to see, I think, more and more of the sort of ritual whispers you get whenever a leader is in trouble, where people start going, oh, you know, he's poorly advised, need to get different people around him, et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, Robert, as Stephen points out, it took Rishi Sunak more than 24 hours to actually come out and say that these remarks were racist. And he was essentially bounced by Kemi Badenoch, or at least that's what, you know, many of his colleagues are saying privately. Stephen also pointed out that he dispatched his spokesperson, he dispatched Mel Stride, a cabinet minister, he dispatched Graham Stewart, another minister, onto the airwaves to hold this line, avoiding calling these remarks racist, before he eventually himself did say they were racist. I mean, that kind of thing, throwing your colleagues to the wolves, that leads to the breakdown of discipline and real resentment behind the scenes, doesn't it?
Yeah, and of course, it's what Boris Johnson did during the Partygate affair, essentially. He sent people out to defend himself. I jokingly, on whatever day this happened, sent out a tweet setting out how the different steps they'll go through, getting each one wrong and being 24 hours behind the curve. And it's almost been proven step by step. And I do think it's an extraordinarily simple rule of politics, which certainly this government seems very bad at, which is look ahead and figure out where you're going to be in 3 days. And if it's a bad story, how about getting there in one? How about just get the pain out of the way? And as Stephen said, the absolute red line for the Conservatives is the money. So get everything else out of the way early. It's incredibly inept. It really is terribly bad for discipline, as you say, because people think they're sent out to take these impossible positions, and then they're the ones left looking stupid. But I mean, fundamentally, you can't blame this on advisors. You can't blame this on anybody else. It goes to the person at the top who, for some reason or another, is reluctant to call what this is. And it's not the first time. And it just speaks to a real sort of lack of political nous, which is an odd thing to say about someone who's managed to become prime minister.
Hannah, what's your take?
Well, I was just really noticing the fact of the people who, even I think before Kemi Badenoch, Andy Street was out there saying, this isn't a decision that, you know, I'm not telling the party what to do, but it isn't a decision that I would be able to hold the line on. I would give the money back. And we've also seen the same from the Scottish Conservatives. And I think...
not my money, I would give it back.
That is really striking, though, in an election year, that people are definitely seeking to differentiate their position when they're looking to their own electorates and are not rowing in behind the Prime Minister on this. Because as Stephen says, they're fairly clear on where they would want to be seen by the electorate, and that is going to play into their own prospects.
Well, we've also seen the Tories try to attack Labour on one of their mega donors, Dale Vince, the green energy industrialist, he's given £2.5 million to the party to date, including a £1 million cheque last year. Stephen, the Tories have picked up on the fact that Dale Vince said late last year with regards to Hamas that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. They think this is appalling and that Labour should give back the money as a result. What do you think?
I think the problem is although those remarks are, yeah, I mean, unfortunately, they're the kind of bromide that people who haven't really engaged with the region have said about Hamas for a very long time. One, the fact that those remarks predate the October 7th atrocity makes them less politically difficult for the Labour Party to navigate. But also, for precisely the reasons Robert laid out about the timing of how the Conservatives had moved, that's kind of where they needed to get on day one. And now at this point, it just comes across as desperate scrabbling. And I think also at this point, for the Conservatives, they just don't want to be on this story because it raises questions about Rishi Sunak's judgment, and really they just need to get off it.
It's also, I mean, it's a very dangerous place. The Conservatives really don't want to get into the broader issue of party donors. It's not a safe space for them, above all, because the only alternative to party donors is state funding. And party donors is a system that massively favours the Conservative Party. They get more money most of the time. They have more people likely to give them vast chunks of cash. So they are the party that least wants state funding. So they really, really don't want this to turn into a broader row about how politics is funded.
It's been such a hectic week and there's almost too much to discuss. But of course, we must mention Lee Anderson's defection to Reform UK, which happened on Monday. Almost seems like ancient
history.
Was
it this week? Lose track.
Let's just step back, Robert, with everything that's happened this week. Lee Anderson's defection has prompted talk of up to 10 other Tories also making the leap. I think perhaps we should take that with a pinch of salt. But there's this febrile atmosphere among the Tories. It's prompting lots of questions about Sunak's authority.
Yeah, I mean, it's all going terribly, terribly wrong. You know, whatever the grid that they have in number 10, Downing Street of announcements, it's not working out. The one thing I would say about Lee Anderson's move is that it's not like normal defections in that he didn't defect from the Conservative Party to Reform. He was thrown out of the Conservative Party and then decided that he belonged with Reform. So it's slightly different. Also, people can recognise that he might consider his chances of holding the seat to be stronger outside of the Conservative Party. But it's really bad because there are people who are sympathetic to him. And he'd become quite a big figure in the Conservative Party, which is also, by the way, goes back to Rishi Sunak's leadership, because Rishi Sunak promoted him because he recognised that Lee Anderson spoke to a part of the Conservative coalition that he didn't and that he needed that part. But he promoted him, put a sort of, you know, a wild card into the pack, and that wild card just, that metaphor is completely exploding on me. That wild card has not worked out to his advantage when the hand was dealt.
Nicely smoothed up. Well, let's change gear and talk about Labour. They've been doing a pretty good job of trying to keep themselves out of the news of late, allowing the Tory melodrama to dominate. But Robert, you had a brilliant column this week that was fascinating on Labour's plan to rebuild relations with the EU. What's their cunning ploy?
Well, I think, as you know, Labour has defined its European policy in negatives, which is all the things it's not going to do, not rejoin the single market, not join the customs union, no freedom of movement. And the only things they've talked about in terms of making Brexit work are really quite incremental things around veterinary deals, youth mobility, such like. And they bigged up in the past the trade agreement that we had post-Brexit, and there's a review due early in the next government, and that they could use that to get a better deal. And I think they've begun to realise after soundings from Brussels that's not the way it's going to work. And so they've started to come up with this new plan, which is to use the idea of an EU-UK security pact, a new one, which everyone can see the case for, particularly given Ukraine and the possibility of a Trump presidency, and then define security really, really broadly so that it takes in economic security, environmental security, security from criminals, and say these are ways we can push ourselves back into the European orbit. So, for example, we might accept a little bit of jurisdiction of the ECJ to get better access to Europol and Schengen data, or we might sign up to the CBAM, the carbon border levy, or we might look at working together on sourcing critical raw materials, and all these things bring the UK back into the European orbit, build stronger relationships with the EU and the Commission, and that perhaps this way you can start to breach the dams that the Tories have erected around their Brexit policy. Now, obviously, there are several caveats we put into this as to whether it could work, but that is the way they're now thinking.
Really interesting intel you've picked up. Hannah, will the EU buy this? They famously hate cherry picking.
I mean, I think Robert's right that the EU has absolutely not been thinking about this review in the same way that it's been talked about here. It's for them, it's much more a technical review of the way in which the agreement is working. That said, security is absolutely the place in which the EU are most likely to look favourably on ways in which they might have a closer relationship with the UK. Is the area where we have something genuine to give, where they value the UK's input. And so this isn't such a bad idea, I don't think, if you want to get the EU interested in developing a more of a closer relationship.
So you're optimistic about the EU going for it. Stephen, what about the public? I mean, does this leave Labour potentially open to the Tory attack line that they'll reverse Brexit or can't be trusted on the EU?
I think in an election campaign, one of the Conservative messages will be that, yeah, Labour will be freedom of movement out behind the back door. And I think one of the known risks to Labour in the election campaign will be a shadow cabinet minister saying something like, yeah, of course, Brexit is a disaster. Because let's face it, we all know that's what they all believe. and so that's kind of a risk to them, regardless of where their policy position is. I think, however, the idea of a security arrangement is broadly fine. That's not going to be politically difficult for them. I actually think the political problem Labour will have is, at the moment, if you are any form of civic society organisation, you know, if you're an orchestra or the CBI or, indeed, as Minette Batters, the departing GenSec of the NFU, National Farming Union, is basically revealed in her sort of farewell interview in The Times, you know, essentially, there is just a general feeling that if you want to get a hearing from most government ministers, you have to be willing to do your kind of shibboleth of global Britain, making Brexit work, even if you hate Brexit, everything about it, and everything about it has made your sector worse. Look, the Association of British Orchestras, or the NFU, or any of these organisations, or touring theatres, is not going to feel remotely hamstrung in saying to a Labour government, Brexit's terrible, this deal doesn't work, why aren't you fixing it? Because that will be popular in the Labour grassroots. You know, every cabinet minister or junior minister who wants to show that they're, you know, doing something that the membership likes at a time when they're going to have these very tight spending rounds is going to want to emphasise their own closeness to the European project. And I think that will actually be the political challenge for Labour. The political class and civic society will want them to get much, much closer than really the EU27 is interested in, and much, much closer than the voters Labour worries about, who make up that third of their coalition, which did want to leave, will want.
And I think Ms. Stephen's right. And actually, probably the greater danger for Labour doesn't come before the election, but after it, which is that when it starts doing these kind of things, if they prove just too incremental for everyone, and they re-emphasise the point that actually, given what you think as Remainers, what you really ought to be doing is rejoining the customs union or making the case for the single market. So I think it doesn't get Labour off of any hooks. The question is whether they begin to move faster and they feel a bit freer talking about this after an election than before.
Hannah, let me turn to you. So on Monday, the IFG, the Institute for Government, your think tank, launched a report from a year-long commission on the centre of government. It was launched by Gordon Brown and John Major, some pretty hefty heavyweights, and you had a very impressive cast of commissioners, Sajid Javid, Louise Casey, Sally Morgan, I could go on, who've all been involved in this really meaty piece of work. I'll link to the full report in the show notes for any listeners who want to see the detail, plus my briefer write-up in the FT. But just tell us, first off, what is the centre of government? Why did you think it's failing or too weak to fulfil its duties?
So our definition of the centre is basically number 10, the Cabinet Office, and the parts of the Treasury which interact with the Cabinet Office number 10. And we felt there was a strong case, looking back at events of recent years, but also much further back, that actually these institutions are largely, many of them, established in the 19th century, but haven't really been seriously looked at and changed and updated, as the business of government has significantly changed over those decades and centuries. We looked at examples like COVID, where the centre really struggled to find the decision-making mechanisms to respond. It got there in the end, but as we're seeing through the COVID inquiry, there were really serious problems with the culture at the centre, and that it really wasn't supporting ministers to be able to make the decisions they needed to make in that context. We also looked at examples like big cross-cutting policies, which we know are increasingly things which governments want to pursue. You can't silo your policy objectives into single departments. You have to find ways of making government respond across the piece. This is something that, you know, Labour is saying it wants to do with missions and so on. Levelling up is an example of a policy where what essentially happened was the centre wasn't sufficiently strategic about what it wanted to achieve, and we ended up with a situation where the Treasury set the budget before the policy had been defined. And so policy had to be retrofitted into the space left by a strategy essentially set by the Treasury. And we just think that's the wrong way around. We need a strong centre which has strategic capability, and the priorities of the government should drive the priorities in the spending review, which determine how the Treasury allocates money across government. Too often that's not the case.
And I wasn't surprised to see two former prime ministers involved in launching your report, because we often hear from former inhabitants of Downing Street that they try to pull levers and realise there's nothing attached to them. And multiple prime ministers, to my mind, Tony Blair's been the most candid and articulate in talking about how he failed to achieve, you know, as much of his agenda as he would have liked, in part perhaps due to these issues at the centre of government. There were lots of interesting, eye-catching recommendations in your report, but I want to focus on two. Firstly, you call for the Cabinet Office to be scrapped altogether. Just explain, I mean, obviously listeners will know what the Cabinet Office is in some senses, but in others, it's sort of an odds and sods department. Just remind us of what it is and why it's not functioning well and what you think should replace it.
Well, originally, the Cabinet Office was designed to be the bit of government which serviced Cabinet. The clue is in the name. And one of the key parts which remains are the secretariats, the bits of government which essentially service the Cabinet itself, and all the Cabinet committees provide their papers, interact with government departments in order to take the business of government to the Cabinet. But over time, the Cabinet Office has grown, and it now is markedly larger than it used to be. It's accumulated all sorts of other things, things that make sense to be at the centre at one point in time or other, but get left there. Things which, together as a group, don't make any sense. And the consistent feedback we had across our year of work as a commission is that the Cabinet Office has really lost credibility. It's got this half, which does sort of secretariat work. It's also got all the functions, which are the things like procurement and finance and so on, which are functions which make sense to be at the centre, but really make the department itself quite incoherent. And those have grown enormously in recent years.
And so you're calling for it to be replaced by?
So we're saying you need to take those things which are about running the civil service out of the Cabinet Office and put them into a separate civil service department where there can be a real focus on government reform and ensuring that the civil service has the capability to deliver on the priorities of government. And then you need to take the secretariats, the bits that work directly to the Prime Minister and Cabinet, and put them into a department of the Prime Minister and Cabinet, which is number 10, plus those secretariat functions. We think that would reduce overlap, it would reduce confusion, which often happens when number 10 and people in the Cabinet Office are tasking bits of government with things that they think are priorities. There's often a lot of overlap and confusion. And we think you need to beef up that central department to really support the Prime Minister and the Cabinet to deliver on their priorities.
Now, another key recommendation of your report is for the Prime Minister of the day to overlook Cabinet, which has become far too bloated. I looked it up. There are currently 32 ministers attending at the moment, and it's become something of a rubber stamping forum rather than really a forum for decision making and proper policy formation. And instead, the Prime Minister should surround themselves by, you said, three or four ministers, a sort of VIP Cabinet to do all those strategic decisions. And interestingly, this is something that Labour is quite interested in taking up.
Well, this is obviously something, a recommendation we've been developing over the course of the commission and talking to lots of different people about, and we're really pleased that Labour has shown an interest in it. We think it's a recognition of the reality that most prime ministers actually, over the course of their premiership, evolve this sort of at least informal mechanism. They all decide eventually that cabinet doesn't work as a decision-making mechanism, and they end up with a smaller group of ministers who they put the key strategic decisions to before taking them to cabinet. We say, why not recognise that? Why not set it up from the start, give it the proper support it needs in the form of a secretariat, and acknowledge that this is something that in the modern world, you have to have those key strategic decisions made in a smaller group. It's a lesson you take from the private sector. No private sector company would have 32 people around the table when they're trying to determine and stick to the priorities and the outcomes they want to achieve.
Robert?
One thing I wanted to ask you about, and it was a fascinating and very persuasive report, but one thought that occurred to me was you have all these prime ministers saying we must toughen the centre and do more to make the centre stronger. And the corollary to that is the absolute enfeebling of all the departments and all the cabinet ministers who run those departments, and that actually, particularly when you get weak figures being put into run those departments, weak cabinet ministers. And I just wondered whether to some extent we oughtn't to be looking at the fact that what this is sort of saying is all our Whitehall departments, they're all rubbish. We absolutely can't count on them to do any of the things that they're meant to do. So we've got to have more civil servants at the centre. And even if we have 6,000 civil servants, that's still dwarfed by what there is in all the departments. And actually, maybe what we ought to be looking at is not the centre, but all the departments.
So what we would say is that actually this isn't about accumulating more people at the centre, and this isn't about the centre doing the job of departments. This is about the centre being really clear about priorities in order to be able to delegate. I absolutely agree with you that we've had too much in recent years of sort of relatively weaker secretaries of state not able to determine their own policy because that's been pulled right into the centre by the prime ministers, various prime ministers. Actually, we would advocate for strong secretaries of state leading their departments. The role of the executive committee is not to make policy for different departments. It's to do the big strategic stuff, which is about setting your fiscal rules. It's about determining what essentially your big things are that you want to say by the end of parliament to the public. These are the things we've delivered on, and to keep a focus on that. And the secretaries of state should absolutely be getting on with the individual policies which are sitting beneath that.
Stephen?
I think the fascinating thing about cabinet, which has become, as a reporter, really bloated, is what I think of as the Esther McVeigh problem. No offence to Esther McVeigh if you listen to this podcast. Right, which is successive Conservative prime ministers have, in a bind, and this is not just a Conservative problem, but just the most recent manifestation of it, in a bind gone, the right of the party is getting cranky. Oh, I know, I need to get someone with credibility with the right in on a non-job. Time to have Esther McVeigh attending cabinet, which I think she's done as a cabinet office minister, she's done as housing minister, and a third job, which temporarily escapes me. But this is one of the reasons why the cabinet has gone, when you compare it even to what it was in 1997 under Major, where they were all significant figures who with real power bases, ditto in the first term of Tony Blair. Isn't there a problem, although this is a great structure on paper, the political imperative to bloat for reasons of patronage is a big part of why the centre is dysfunctional?
I think there's absolutely something in that. I think that the advantage of what we're proposing is that you can keep your large cabinet. Cabinet is obviously constitutionally very important, and we've seen in recent years how you sometimes need a cabinet to do its job in terms of removing a leader, essentially, if things aren't working out. You can achieve all those different sorts of balance, party balance, other sorts of balance that you want across your larger cabinet. But in terms of your key strategic decisions, you have this smaller group to whom you might have to invite other secretaries of state for particular decisions and so on. It doesn't have to be particularly exclusive, but you have those strong characters who you really want the advice of sitting at the centre. And another advantage of this is that often we think that too many decisions are made bilaterally between a prime minister and the chancellor. And in the end, the chancellor often has the whip hand in terms of there is no money, prime minister. If you introduce another couple of ministers into that dynamic, that can really help in terms of making it a more sort of strategic and not just money-driven decision.
I have to ask, are you more embarrassed that you broadly agree with Dominic Cummings, or do you think he's more embarrassed that he broadly agrees with you?
We have often agreed with Dominic Cummings and his analysis of the problems. We don't always agree with him on his solutions.
Well, we've just got time left for Political Fix's stock picks. Robert, who are you buying or selling?
Well, I was thinking of selling the Tory treasurers for the reasons we've discussed, but since I can't actually definitely remember who the current head of the Treasury team is, I think it's Graham Edwards, I'm actually going to revert and actually I'm going to buy Kemi Badenoch, because this week she showed her own party what political leadership looks like a little bit in jumping in to the Hester row and saying, this is racism, and also then doing a feint to her right by saying, but we should accept apologies when they come. She showed an understanding of how you get your party behind you, how you take a position, get ahead of the curve, and showed up Rishi Sunak into the process. And I think she will have appealed to both sides of her party. I'm not talking about the country, that's a different matter, but Tories are only talking to themselves at the moment.
Well, I'm also going to leap in because I'm buying Kemi Badenoch too. We haven't really discussed it. No. I think it's great. I just want to make sure I'm not, you know, not outdone in the buying Badenoch stakes. I thought, you know, fascinating that some of her allies are talking up the fact that she was the first senior minister to comment on the government intervening on the Telegraph sale. And as the government has finally indicated this week that it is going to take action to prevent foreign governments from buying British newspapers, again, I think her judgment seems pretty good. Hannah.
Well, as you might expect, I think I would sell the Cabinet Office because having just explained to you why we think its days ought to be numbered, we hope that that is something that whoever forms the government after the next election would take on board. If I'm allowed a second one, I would potentially buy Pat McFadden, who currently, of course, is leading the campaign planning for Labour, but has been talked up in the context of reporting that Labour is interested in our ideas about this executive committee or quad or whatever you call it at the centre, should they win the election. He's been talked up as a member of that, and that would be an interesting role for him to take on.
Stephen.
I am going to buy stock in Diane Abbott, who obviously is the person who's been, you know, personally insulted by these remarks, who, as listeners may recall, had lost the Labour whip after she sent a letter to The Observer suggesting that Jewish people and people from a Gypsy, Roma or Traveller background did not experience racism, they experienced prejudice, for which she had the whip revoked.
Prejudice akin to having red hair.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, look, I think it was correct and she had the whip taken from her, and I find it frustrating that I think what's happening this week is a manifestation of what happens whenever someone experiences racism, that there's this kind of weird referendum on the character of the person who's experienced it, right? And so in an odd way, what's happened is because the remarks as reported are so open and shut racist, it's kind of like what's happened is people have decided, and it means that Diane Abbott can't have done anything too bad with her statement in The Observer, which means a bunch of people across the Labour Party, you know, from Harriet Harman to Angela Rayner, have called for her to get the whip back. It also does give the Labour leadership a way of giving her a path back into the parliamentary party. They are worried about how it lands electorally if you end the career of the first black woman ever to be elected to parliament by removing the whip from her. And so I think that this will in the end mean that she does get the whip restored. Of course, she may then in the end decide that she doesn't want to stand of her own volition, but I think it does mean she'll get the whip back.
Stephen Bush, Robert Shrimsley, Hannah White, thanks for joining.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thanks, Lucy.
Cheers, Lucy.
That's it for this episode of the FT's Political Fix. I've put links to subjects discussed in the episode in the show notes. Do check them out. They're articles we've made free for Political Fix listeners. There's also a link there to Stephen Bush's award-winning Inside Politics newsletter. You'll get 30 days free. And don't forget to subscribe to the show. Plus, do leave a review or a star rating if you have time. It really helps us spread the word. Political Fix was presented by me, Lucy Fisher, and produced by Audrey Tinlin with help from Leah Quinn. Manuela Saragossa is the executive producer. Original music and sound engineering by Breen Turner. Cheryl Bramley is the FT's global head of audio. We'll meet again here next week.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.